The scripture reading this morning is from Matthew 16, and it is verses 13 to 28. Hear God's word. Now when Jesus came into the district of Caesarea Philippi, he asked his disciples, "Who do people say that the Son of Man is?" And they said, "Well, some say John the Baptist, others Elijah, and others Jeremiah, or one of the prophets." He said to them, "But who do you say that I am?" Simon Peter replied, "You are the Christ, the Son of the living God." And Jesus answered him, "Blessed are you, Simon Barjona, for flesh and blood has not revealed this to you, but my Father who is in heaven. And I tell you, you are Peter, and on this rock I will build my church, and the gates of hell shall not prevail against it. I will give you the keys of the kingdom of heaven, and whatever you bind on earth will be bound in heaven, and whatever you loose on earth shall be loosed in heaven." Then he strictly charged the disciples to tell no one that he was the Christ. From that time, Jesus began to show his disciples that he must go to Jerusalem and suffer many things from the elders and chief priests and scribes and be killed, and on the third day be raised. And Peter took him aside and began to rebuke him, saying, "Far be it from you, Lord, that this shall never happen to you." But Jesus turned and said to Peter, "Get behind me, Satan. You are a hindrance to me. For you are setting your mind on the things, or not setting your mind on the things of God, but on the things of man." And then Jesus told his disciples, "If anyone would come after me, let him deny himself and take up his cross and follow me. For whoever would save his life will lose it. But whoever loses his life for my sake will find it. For what will it profit a man if he gains the whole world and forfeits his soul? Or what shall a man give in return for his soul? For the Son of Man is going to come with angels in the glory of his Father. And then he will repay each person according to what he has done. Truly I say to you, there are some standing here who will not taste death until they see the Son of Man coming in his kingdom." This is God's word.
Good morning. Welcome to Midtown Community Church. Thanks for springing forward with us this morning, this early morning. I appreciate y'all being faithful to the alarm clock this morning and coming and joining us. My name is Gordon Fleming. I can't remember if I just said that. I'm one of the pastors here. I'm glad you're here. We're currently going through a sermon series called A King Unlike Any Other. And we're getting near the end of the series. And Lindsay and I have commented, and we've even heard from some of you, that this has been a really enjoyable sermon series. For the last 3 months, we've been asking the question, what are the unique things about Jesus that would lead us and countless others to believe that he's the Messiah, that he's the Christ, that we're told in Matthew 1:21, he has come to save his people from their sins? Why would we believe that about him? And so we've been looking at that all throughout the last few weeks, and it's been a real enjoyable way for me to at least study this book of the Bible. And we come to a passage this morning which we've referenced several times over the last few weeks. It's a time in Jesus' earthly ministry when he goes to the disciples and he says, "Who do you say that I am?" And Peter speaks up for the disciples and he says, "We know that you are the Christ, the Son of the living God." And this passage has really been the basis for our entire sermon series. And for the book of Matthew, the passage serves as the climax, or really the turn of the book. You know, when you think about all the great stories, all the great movies, the great books, they share this literary dynamic, a building action of the story that climaxes in a moment, and then there's a transition and a falling trajectory of the story that ends in resolution. This past week, I thought about some of my favorite stories and how they share this similar pattern and dynamic. I thought about the movie Hoosiers, one of my favorite movies of all time, and how Coach Dale and the Hickory Huskers were struggling. Things were going so poorly until Jimmy Chitwood shows up and says, "It's time that I play ball." I think about Victor Hugo's Les Miserables when Jean Valjean has the dramatic interaction with Javert in the Paris sewers as the rebellion rages on and he ultimately spares his life. I think about Forrest Gump when Jenny returns home to Forrest and they're like peas and carrots. once again. And I absolutely am not going to talk about The Greatest Showman this week. Kelly asked me last night, are you going to do it? And I said, no, so I'm not going to, but if I were, you could argue that the climax of that movie is the singing of the anthem, This Is Me. And so you see this pattern all throughout literature, movies, books, poems. And so if this is true of all the great stories, you can be assured that it's also true of the greatest story. And this morning, we're on the front row of it. Up until this point in our study of the book of Matthew, we've seen that Jesus is a force to be reckoned with. We've seen that He has absolute authority over nature, over evil, over other teachers and rabbis. Now, you and I have the luxury of reading this 2,000 years after it happened. We know about His genealogy in Matthew 1 that we studied a few weeks ago. We know about His bloodline. We know about the Easter story. We know how it's ultimately going to end. The disciples didn't have this context, nor did the people that were following Jesus. They saw it in real time. They see what He's doing, and they obviously know that He's special, that something's different about Him, but they don't truly understand who He is. And we see this most clearly in the lives of the disciples, because they waffle between being terrified of Him, to worshiping Him, to trying to use Him to accomplish their own personal agendas. Up until this point in the book of Matthew, we haven't seen that He's actually God incarnate. And finally this morning, it's revealed. It's revealed that this is who He is. It's the pivot point of the book. It's the climax of the story. And now the story begins to turn towards its resolution. All right, so what's going on here? Earlier in chapter 16, Jesus is along the shores of the Sea of Galilee, and He has a confrontation with the Pharisees and the Sadducees. And we're told that after the confrontation that He leaves and He makes the 24-mile trek with His disciples to Caesarea Philippi. It's a beautiful city at the base of the 9,000-foot Mount Hermon. It's at the mouth of the Jordan River. It's a place that Jesus often retreated to with His disciples or to be alone for prayer. And this is the backdrop for where the questions take place. Right? Who do people say that I am? Who do you say that I am? And with Peter's answer, we have something taking place for the first time in all human history, and specifically for the first time in the book of Matthew. Right here, verse 16, it's the first time that a human has ever verbalized Jesus as the Christ. Two other times in the book of Matthew, it happens. One is God at Jesus' baptism in Matthew 3, and the second one is actually a demon in Matthew 8. So right here, we have the first human declaration that Jesus is God. And look at how Jesus responds. Again, this is verse 17. He says, "Blessed are you, Simon Bar-Jonah, or Simon son of Jonah, for flesh and blood has not revealed this to you, but my Father who is in heaven. And I tell you, you are Peter, and on this rock I will build my church, and the gates of hell shall not prevail against it. I will give you the keys of the kingdom of heaven, and whatever you bind on earth shall be bound in heaven, and whatever you loose on earth shall be loosed in heaven." So clearly this is a big deal. Jesus is saying, you're right. I am the Messiah. And on this statement and on the fact and the reality of who I am, I'm going to build my church. And so it seems that for the first time in the book of Matthew, that the disciples actually get something right. So what does Peter mean? When he calls Jesus the Christ, the Son of the living God, what is he talking about? Well, the word that he's using there literally means the anointed one. And there's references to this all throughout the Old Testament, but specifically we see it in the book of Jeremiah where it says this, "Behold, the days are coming, declares the Lord, when I will raise up for David a righteous branch, and he shall reign as king and deal wisely, and shall execute justice and righteousness in the land. In his days, Judah will be saved, and Israel will dwell securely. And this is the name by which he will be called, the Lord is our righteousness." So Peter gets it right. He says, this is you. This is who you are. You're the one that we've been waiting for so long, to come and set everything straight, to make everything right. You're the one that's going to save us, to have us dwell securely. And Jesus says, you're right. I will make everything right. But then he immediately turns around and starts to say some things that are appalling and shocking. He says, yes, I'm the king, but nothing like the king that you were expecting. Let's look again at what he says in verse 21. So he immediately turns to his disciples and he says, "From that time, Jesus began to show his disciples that he must go to Jerusalem and suffer many things from the elders and the chief priests and the scribes and be killed and on the third day be raised. And Peter took him aside and began to rebuke him, saying, 'Far be it from you, Lord. This shall never happen to you.' But then he turned and said to Peter, 'Get behind me, Satan, you're a hindrance to me, for you are not setting your mind on the things of God, but on the things of man.'" What is going on here? This is so confusing. Right? In one sentence, you see Jesus saying, "Peter, blessed are you." And then in the next sentence, it almost appears that he's calling him Satan. It seems a bit harsh, but we need to understand the context from which Peter is talking about. And Matthew alludes to this in verse 13 when Jesus refers to himself as the Son of Man. This is one of 24 references to Jesus being called the Son of Man in the book of Matthew. And it comes from the Old Testament book of Daniel, where it talks about one coming like a Son of Man, a divine messianic figure who's going to come with the angels and he's going to set everything right. And he's going to come in power and glory and dominion, and he's going to usher in an everlasting kingdom. God made this promise 600 years ago, and so they've been waiting for this messianic figure to come, this Son of Man. And Jesus is saying, "I'm the Son of Man." He's saying, "I'm here." But then he says that he must suffer. And this is really confusing because never before had Israel associated suffering with the Son of Man or the Messiah. In Isaiah, there's this mysterious servant of the Lord who suffered, but nobody really thought this was going to be the Messiah. The notion of the Messiah would suffer made no sense at all, because the Messiah is supposed to bring victory. He's coming to defeat evil and injustice and set the world right. And how can you do that if you're suffering and dying? That seems ridiculous or impossible. And so Peter hears this and he takes Jesus aside, and it says that he rebukes him, which is the same word that's used when Jesus goes to cast out demons, when he confronts demons. And so Peter, very harshly, feeling a little overconfident, a little too big for his britches, comes over to Jesus and says, "Hey, you've got it all wrong. Let me give you a little history lesson here. The Son of Man, the Messiah, comes in victory, not in defeat. He brings glory, not suffering. He brings power, not weakness. You've got it all wrong." And Jesus says, "No, you've got it all wrong. In fact, you couldn't be more wrong." I love how Eugene Peterson paraphrases this in The Message, where he says, "But Jesus didn't swerve. 'Peter, get out of my face. Satan, get lost. You have no idea how God works.'" Now, let's not be so hard on Peter, because his reaction should really resonate with us. Because in a lot of ways, we feel like life as a Christian should be something like the movie Facing the Giants. Okay, so Facing the Giants is a movie about a high school football coach in Georgia, and his football team is terrible. He and his wife are struggling with infertility, and his truck keeps breaking down. So what happens? Well, he becomes a Christian, and his team wins state, his wife gets pregnant, and he gets a new truck. Okay, so this really isn't how Christianity works, but on some level, we all wish that it would. And we all think that Jesus came to give us these types of benefits. If you don't believe me, go to a Christian bookstore and look at some of the best-selling titles that are out there. Your Best Life Now, Think Better, Live Better, Become a Better You, Every Day a Friday, 30 Thoughts for Victorious Living, and the list goes on and on and on. Oftentimes, either explicitly or implicitly, we want Christianity to be like this, our best life here on earth right now. And when it doesn't go that way, it's super confusing. I can remember a few years ago, I was in Uganda on a mission trip, and I was talking to one of the pastors in the church that we were serving with, and he was sharing with me the challenges of being a Christian in Uganda. And he was talking about how he has to deal with witch doctors almost weekly, and how he's had to live through murderous dictators, and how they face demonic, violent activity all the time. And I was just astounded hearing these stories, and I said, "How do you do it? I mean, how are you able to remain faithful in the midst of so much pain and suffering?" And he looked at me with this really confused look on his face. And I'll never forget what he said to me. He said, "I'm not sure that you and I worship the same Jesus. Because Jesus said it wasn't going to be easy here. He promised us that on this earth we were going to have suffering." I remember when I heard that, I felt like I was about 2 inches tall. Because I realized in that moment that there's a huge disconnect in my own life personally. I could tell you all day, yeah, John 16, Jesus said, in this world you will have suffering. I knew that at a head level, but the reality was, at the end of the day, I too expected my life to be good here as a Christian. And this is why for all of my Christian life, I was always really confused when things didn't work out how I expected them to. And I would blame myself, thinking it was that if something was hard, if something was going wrong, that I was doing something wrong. And it was my fault. Or if life was going good, I took great pride because I was living my life in the way that I was supposed to. And I know that we deal with this all the time. I know that some of you are dealing with it now. You may say, I'm following God, so why am I still single? I'm following God. Why can't I get pregnant? Why was I passed over for this promotion? Why are terrible things going on at work? Why did I lose someone that I love very much? At our core, we've seen all throughout human history that man believes that truly good things should happen to good people. And when it doesn't, it's very, very confusing. At the end of the day, all of us on some level believe that Christianity is a prosperity gospel. All throughout Scripture, we see this constant theme. And that's why it's so confusing when Jesus comes and He says, yes, I'm a king, but I'm a king going to a cross. Peter and the disciples would be super confused to hear something like this, or maybe even offended. And look at what Jesus says in verse 21. He doesn't tell them that He will suffer, or that He might be rejected, or that He possibly will be killed, or He probably will rise again. He doesn't say, hey, I'm going to go to Jerusalem, I'm going to fight this battle, but the outcome is uncertain, I might lose. He says, I must suffer. I must be rejected. The word must modifies the complete sentence, the whole sentence, because it says that everything on the list that he just named is a necessity. He must suffer. He must be rejected. He must die. And he must be resurrected. This is one of the most significant words in all of cosmic history. And when you think about it, it's actually really scary. Because he says, this is why I've come. It's absolutely necessary for me to die. This world can't be renewed. You can't be renewed. Your life can't be renewed unless I die. It requires my death. This is my mission. This is why I came. And it changes everything. When that's his mission, it changes everything because it means to follow Jesus, you're following a king that's heading to a cross. Let's look at what he says. In verse 24, it says, he told his disciples, if anyone would come after me, he must deny himself and take up his cross and follow me. For whoever would save his life will lose it, and whoever loses his life for my sake will find it. For what will it profit a man if he gains the whole world and forfeits his soul? Or what shall a man give in return for his soul? For the Son of Man is going to come with the angels in the glory of his Father, and he will repay each person according to what he has done. Truly I say to you, there are some standing here who will not taste death until they see the Son of Man coming in his kingdom. All right, so what's Jesus talking about? And obviously he's not talking about winning high school state football championship games. He's not talking about making money or getting a good parking spot at the mall. And he's certainly not talking about building an earthly militaristic revolution. This is not a theology of glory. This train's not heading for glory, he's saying. This is a theology of the cross, something that Martin Luther talked about. It's the knowledge and understanding that to really be a follower of Jesus, our identity is to be rooted in the glory of the cross, not the glory of our accomplishments. Okay, we see this specifically in the word that Jesus uses for life in verse 25. The word is psyche. It's where we get our word psychology. He's talking about your identity. He's talking about your soul. And so verse 25 literally reads this way. Jesus says, for whoever would save his identity will lose it. But whoever loses his identity for my sake will find it. Now this is really, really hard for us. Because on some level, we're all a lot like Joshua Baskin in the movie Big. Now my fear is I've just lost an entire generation because you don't know the movie Big. But this year is the 30th anniversary of Tom Hanks' movie, Big. And the movie is about a 12-year-old boy who thinks that all of his problems will be solved if he could just be a little bit older, if he could just be a little bigger. He goes to a carnival and he's trying to impress this older girl. And he goes to get in line to get on a ride. And the guy goes, you're not big enough. You've got to be this tall. You've got to go. And so he's completely embarrassed. And he runs off and he goes to this antique fortune teller machine. It's called Zoltar Speaks. And he puts in his coin and he flicks the button and he says, I want to be big. And then he looks and the thing's unplugged. And it says, your wish is granted. And so he thinks it's kind of weird, but he goes home and he goes to sleep. And the next morning he wakes up and he's 30 years old. He's Tom Hanks. Literally, his wish became true overnight. And it looks initially like it pays off because he goes to New York and he gets the really cool apartment and he gets his dream job working for a toy company and he gets the girl. But eventually the luster wears off. He realizes that becoming big hasn't really solved his problem. In fact, it's actually created new problems. People he works with begin to hate him. He loses his best friend. He becomes alienated from his family, and he wants to go back to the way that things once were when he was 12. And this is the story of our lives. We have these things, we have these idols that we think, if I just had that, all of my problems would be solved. If I just had that man, or if I just had that woman, if I just had their marriage, if I just had kids that behaved like them, or a job like he or she has, then everything would be great. If I just had the respect and the approval of my parents, then everything would be just where I need it to be. And Jesus says, no. He says, that will never work. Because even if you gain the whole world, it won't be big enough, or bright enough, or shiny enough, or good enough. Because, you know, like Josh Baskin, sometimes we get those things. But, you know, the problem with idols is that they keep jumping off the altar. And we find ourselves moving at this crazy speed that we always need more. We always need something else. And we're dealing with a whole new set of problems. If you build your identity on being loved by somebody or having a certain job, what happens if those things go away? Then you feel like you've lost your life. You feel like you're falling apart. You feel as if you've lost everything. Now, do you feel how countercultural it is what Jesus is saying here? Jesus is saying, all the things in this world will only leave you wanting more. But if you find your identity, if you find your soul in me, it's then and only then that you'll ever really live. Well, how do we do this? Well, Jesus tells us here in verse 24, he says that we need to deny ourselves, take up our cross daily, and follow him. Now, I have to admit, this week as I studied this passage, just like it does every time I come across this passage, it really trips me up. Because I grew up in churches, like many of you, that value behavior modification over life change. I had a youth pastor, and I've said this before, once tell me don't drink, smoke, chew, or go with girls that do. When I was 13, I had to sign an abstinence pledge promising to be pure until I got married. When I was in college, I was told, hey, listen, if you really want to walk with the Lord, then you can't drink beer, right? You can't do anything that looks kind of looks like you're going to get something that Jesus would want you to do. Don't go to parties. Don't do anything that would reflect badly on Jesus. I was told if you're going to be a good Christian, then you need to memorize specific books of the Bible and you need to walk up to people on the beach and randomly tell them about Jesus. And so in a very real way, in an environment like that, Christianity sounded to me like it wasn't really fun and you had to work really hard. And so when I hear this and I hear things about taking your cross daily and following Him, I'm thinking, oh man, here we go. It sounds like Jesus is saying we have to deny ourselves anything worldly or anything fun. You need to go be a missionary in a foreign country. You need to lose your life for Him. And you know, it's the least you can do because remember what He did for you. That's initially what I hear when I read this passage, but that's not what he's saying. That's not what he's saying at all. It couldn't be any further from what he's saying, because when Jesus says to deny yourself, to take up your cross and follow him, what he's saying is, listen, you don't have to let what you've done define you, right or wrong, the good things or the bad things. Let what I've done define you. Remember in the gospel story, we're not the ones who carried the cross. It was Jesus. As I mentioned earlier, this is the real advantage that we have over the disciples. They wouldn't know what this means at this point. They've not seen Jesus carry his cross yet, and they wouldn't fully understand it until his death on the cross. But we do. We can know what it means right here and right now because we know what Jesus did. So on the cross, what did Jesus accomplish? As we carry our crosses, and as we seek to live in Luther's theology of the cross, what do we live under? Well, we live under the things that Jesus said that he must do. That he must go to Jerusalem, and that he must be killed, and he must be resurrected. They have to live under the good news of the gospel. So what does that mean? When we talk about the gospel, what does that mean? This is a question that we can't ask enough. I remember hearing a definition of the gospel a few years ago that really changed my understanding of it. This is from the late Pastor Jack Miller, where he said, "You're more sinful than you think, but you're more loved than you dared imagine." I love how the Apostle Paul paints this beautiful picture of the gospel in Romans. This is Romans 5, where he says, "For while we were still weak, at the right time Christ died for the ungodly. For one will scarcely die for a righteous person, though perhaps for a good person one would dare even to die. But God shows His love for us that while we were still sinners, while we were still ungodly sinners, Christ died for us." Now, I hope you can hear this. This is why the gospel is good news. Because it's not about good people getting what they deserve, right? It's not about winning the state football championship or getting, you know, a new truck or anything like that. That's not Christianity, that's karma. Good people getting what they deserve is called a job. Christianity is bad people not getting what they deserve. It's bad people absolutely getting something that they don't deserve. While we were running away from Jesus, He came after us. Jesus Christ, the only one to ever fully obey God perfectly, died so that He could restore God's relationship to a bunch of lawbreakers. Do you see that? Do you see how significant that is? That'll change somebody. Knowing that there's nothing that we can do to earn God's love, and that there's nothing that we can do to lose it. And Jesus is telling His disciples, and consequently us, that this needs to be your psyche. This needs to be your soul. This needs to be your identity. And when we live this way, it's incredibly freeing. It removes a ton of pressure of how we are to live our lives. Okay, so if this were true of us, if we really got this, well, what would it look like? Well, I want us to look at a couple of implications, three implications, in the remainder of our passage, very briefly. So let's look here. This is verse 25. This is the first one where Jesus says, "For whoever would save his life will lose it, but whoever loses his life for my sake will find it." One way that we know that we're really living under the cross is that we begin to stop looking at achievement or success or relationships or our careers or our stuff for significance. We realize that the stuff isn't that important. It just kind of goes away. Listen to what C.S. Lewis wrote in Mere Christianity. This is the quote on the front of your bulletin where he says, "Give up yourself and you will find your real self. Lose your life and you will save it. Submit to death, the death of your ambitions and favorite wishes every day and the death of your whole body in the end. Submit with every fiber of your being and you will find eternal life. Keep back nothing. Nothing that you have not given away will be really yours. Nothing in you that has not died will ever be raised from the dead. Look for yourself and you will find in the long run only hatred, loneliness, despair, rage, ruin, and decay. But look for Christ and you will find Him. And with Him, everything else thrown in." When this becomes true of us, it frees us up tremendously. Because at this point, we can love people without needing their approval. We can enjoy our work because we're not consumed with our job title or our bank account. We're not identified by our stuff, because our stuff is no longer our identity. Our identity, our psyche, is what Jesus did for you. It's no longer whatever earthly house of cards you're trying like crazy to build for yourself. Another implication of living in the reality of what Jesus has done for us is that we actually begin to live for Him and to live for others. But not to earn His love, but because we already have His love. And it moves us out. Look again, this is verse 27. It says, "For the Son of Man is going to come with His angels in the glory of His Father, and then He will repay each person according to what he has done." Each person according to what he or she has done. Now this brings up a question. What is it that we need to do? And this is a valid question. This is one that the disciples actually asked Jesus in John 6. They went to Him and they said, "Okay, Jesus, what are the works, plural, of God that we need to do?" And Jesus said, "This is the work, singular, of God, that you believe in whom He has sent." Now, when we get this at a heart level, that God sent His Son, as Jesus said, into our lives and into our world, then something happens. It actually moves us out into the lives, into the world of others. Now, I'm not trying to say that this means that we need to wear Lord's Gems t-shirts or get a fish for the back of our car or a bumper sticker that says, "My boss is a Jewish carpenter." But what I'm saying is that when you really get the gospel and that it's good news, you're so overwhelmed by the goodness of His grace, not based on what you've done, but what Jesus has done, that it becomes a part of your vernacular. You actually begin to talk about it. It molds and shapes how you live your life, how you value others, because you realize personally that you're only a beggar. But you're a beggar that knows where you can find bread. You know, one of the things I love about all of the gospel accounts, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, is that they're incredibly honest, even when it makes them look really bad. They are very honest about there were times that they were weak and that they were scared, that they pledged their allegiance to Jesus, and that they crumbled under pressure. You know, on the most horrifying night of Jesus' life, they completely abandoned Him. All right, even Peter, the rock, right, who we just read about, Jesus said, "I'm going to build my church on what you've just said." You're right. Peter denied Jesus 3 times in one night. It was only on this side of the cross that the gospel became really good news to them. The gospel freed them up to be honest about the fact that they were beggars. And it was this honesty that moved them out into the lives of others, to tell others about the never giving up love of Jesus. The third way that I want us to see the evidence of bearing our crosses is actually my favorite thing in this passage. I love it, and it's so easy to miss, but it's absolutely beautiful. Early in the passage, as we saw, yes, the disciples, "Well, who do people say that I am?" And they say, "Well, some people say that you're Elijah, or some people say you're John the Baptist, some people that say that you're another prophet." But then Jesus leans in and He asks a follow-up question. It's an incredibly vulnerable statement if you think about it. Vulnerable question. He says, "But who do you say that I am?" You know, it's really easy for me to go to Kelly and say, "Hey, you know, who do people say that I am? What do people in the church think of me? Do they think I'm nice or good or kind? What is it that they think?" It's different if I go to her and I say, "Well, what do you think about me?" At that point, I'm really taking a risk, because I'm risking that she could really hurt me and say things that could really hurt me. Jesus, whose identity was fully grounded in God's love more than anybody else who's ever walked this earth, could easily ask this question. He would have no problem asking this question, because He remembered and He knew what was true in Matthew 3 when at His baptism God said, "You are My beloved Son, in whom I am well pleased." Once we find our identity in God's approval for us, that we are more loved than we could dare imagine, then we can give people access to our hearts. Because it's not the words that people say that ultimately form who we are, but it's God's word to us that form us. It's that God looks at us and He says, "You are My beloved Son, you are My beloved daughter, in whom I am well pleased." You know, over the years, I've had many conversations with people about what they don't like about Christianity. That it's too exclusive, or that Christians are too judgmental, or that the church is full of hypocrites. There's been a lot of pain inflicted by the institutional church on a lot of people, and that's a shame, and that's really sad, because at the end of the day, none of that really matters. What really matters is how you can answer Jesus' question. When He looks at you and says, "Who do you say that I am?" That is literally the most important question that you could ever ask in your entire life. And you're doing yourself an incredible disservice if you don't ask yourself that question. Who do you say that He is? The consequences of not asking that question could be enormous. Because if you say, "Well, you know, I think Jesus is a good man or a good teacher, but I don't think He was God in the flesh walking on this earth." Well, He didn't leave you to make that conclusion, because He said He was God incarnate. So either He was, or He was delusional or a maniacal liar. If you say, "Well, I believe that Jesus was God, and I believe that He can give me the boost to where I want to get in my life." Again, Jesus says no. Just like He said to Peter, "You're setting your mind on the things of man, not of God." But if you say, "I believe and I know that He's the Christ. He's the King of Kings who's going to make everything right. He's going to make death go away. He's going to make all things new. And He came to save His people from their sins. And I know I'm one of His people. And through His perfect life and terrible death and glorious resurrection, I know that I'm saved. To that, Jesus says, yes. He says, now, come and follow Me. You know, every week we come to this table to be reminded that we have this King, that every step He took on this earth, He was walking to a cross. This table is a tangible reminder of the broken body of Jesus for us. And it's a place that we can come, and as Paul said, we can examine ourselves and we can say, well, what do I believe? Do I believe that He's the Christ? Do I believe that He's the King? This table is a place for anyone who acknowledges Jesus Christ as their King. This table is for anyone who looks to Jesus alone and rests on Him alone for salvation. If that's not you, then frankly, this table isn't for you yet. Don't come to this table and do something that you don't believe in. Don't violate your own conscience. Instead, keep your seat. Nobody will notice. But come back. This church is a great place to ask questions, and we would love to dialogue with you about who Jesus is. We're told, Paul tells us in 1 Corinthians that on the night that Jesus was to be betrayed, that He took the bread and He broke it and He blessed it and He gave it to His disciples and He said, this is My body broken for you. Take and eat in remembrance of Me. And we're also told that after supper He took the cup and in the same manner He said, this is My blood shed for many for the remission of sin. Take and drink. So it's our practice here at Midtown that everyone will come and you'll be served the elements and you'll take them back to your seat and then I will speak the words of institution and then we will take the bread and the grape juice together. If you do want a gluten-free option, I'll have that in my aisle. And so let me pray, and then for those of you that are serving communion, if you'd come down front, that would be great. Father, thank You that oftentimes what You tell us in Your Word is really confusing. But just like the disciples when You spoke in parables, the whole goal of the parables was for the disciples to come to You and say, hey, what did You mean? And so we can come and we can hear You say with things like that we need to take up our cross daily and follow You. And You invite us to come to You in prayer and say, well, what does that mean? And You ask us the question, who do You say that I am? And You cause us to think very deeply about these things. And so, Father, I pray that we would have the courage to think very deeply about who You are to us. Thank You that You've not left us with the conclusion that You're either just a good teacher or that You're some sort of prophet. But we can only proclaim You as God or crazy. And so, Father, I pray that we would look to Your Son and His perfect life and the work that He did here on earth and His glorious resurrection, we would say that's our King, and that we would now come and be fed by faith by our King. In Your name I pray. Amen.